Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
All right, so moved. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3394 and open a work session on House Bill 3395. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3395 to be moved to Workforce and Economic Development Committee.
Without
any recommendation.
Great. Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 3395 to the Committee on Workforce and Economic Development without recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved. I'm going to close that work session on 3395 and open the work session on House Bill 3396. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I recommend that I move move House Bill 3396 to, let's see, this would go to Workforce and Economic Development with no recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 3396 to the Committee on Workforce and Economic Development without a recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved. Close the work session on 3396 and open a work session on Senate Bill 95. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I recommend and move that we send Senate Bill 95 to Consumer Protection Committee with no recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 95 to the Committee on Consumer Protection. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 95. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2901.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2901 is sponsored by Representative Butler at the request of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Oregon Association of County Treasurers. The measure changes current collateralization procedures and requirements for deposits of public funds, and there's currently a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on the measure.
Very good. Representative Butler, please.
What's the number?
2901.
It's and on
folks,
the back.
We're a little out of order today, and
they didn't see it. A lot of people's staff didn't see it.
And the agenda is
on the back,
and because Representative Butler has some business he has to attend to somewhere else in the Capitol. Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Representative, District 60, Tom Butler from Ontario, Oregon. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for hearing this bill today. I want to particularly express gratitude for your taking it out of order so that I can head back up to Senator Representative Byers' Transportation Commission, where we're going to get more opportunity to talk about helmets on people that climb ladders as well as ATVs. House Bill 2901 is the result of a year-long work group, which I had requested that a group of folks get together following session in 2005 to see if they couldn't come to some kind of a compromise as to how local funds from local entities, local taxing entities and taxing districts could be better protected. And so this is a comprehensive reform in the state statutes dealing with the collateralization of public funds and how they are deposited. The members of the work group included bankers, included the county treasurers, the state treasurer's office was represented, the attorney general, as well as DCBS. Lots of good folks came to the table and spent a lot of time. You'll be able to hear from a number of those folks today, and they'll tell you specifically the compromise that they have come to and how this bill is brought to you. It does represent the work of virtually hundreds of hours donated by these good folks to try and get together and figure out a way to best securitize and protect and collateralize public funds. And I think that's very, very important to us in good economic times and bad, that we have those funds, number one, locally in our banks so that we're able to count on them being there in the local community, as well as protected as they are in the local banks. And I understand that today that you will have actually the amendment prepared by the group, which were just finalized this week. I don't think that you're in possession of them, so I'm sorry I cannot tell you which dash amendment it will be that they have finally, but I think it will be the dash one because I know of no other amendments coming before the committee. Again, this does represent a good compromise of all of the parties that are there. I think that I will make this expression to you that the bankers are at the table on this round. I think it's important that we walk before we can run. if we can get this worked out so that this works well with Oregon's significant banking community, then maybe we'll have other options in the future, but we need to be able to bring this to the table at this particular time and make it work. And again, I would strongly encourage the members of the committee to weigh seriously and consider seriously House Bill 2901 with the amendment that will come forward from the work group, and use your best judgment to pass this to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Is there any questions for the representative?
Thank you
very much. All right, I'm going to call Sherry Anderson, my county treasurer from Clackamas County. You all want to be together with Mr. Martinez, Key Sherman, and Lark Wisham?
Wisham.
There's only three chairs, so one of you is going to have to sit back there until it's a chance to talk. All right, Mr. Martinez is just a handy guy to have around.
Good, yeah.
I've hurt your back, Tim. Don't come suing us. All right, whoever wants to go first, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. I'm going to be the briefest, so I get to go first. You have the expert sitting here to my right that can go into the details of the bill. But I don't know if Mr. Butler has left already, but we want to thank him. Last session, he called us in and said, I'm going to put a work group together. And as we all know, work groups are not necessarily our favorite things to do in the interim. But as Representative Butler mentioned, we did spend almost a year. These are three of the very key people that spent time doing that. This issue has been around this process for at least 10 years that I can remember. And I'm really happy to say that we've come to the point where I think all sides that were part of the work group are in agreement. And I would just turn it over to Lark Wisham, who is a board member. Or Sherry, you want to go first?
Thanks.
No, they're passing all the way down to Ken. So you get to hear the lawyer first, who, Mr. Chair, has been instructed to be brief. So,
thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ken Sherman, Jr. I'm a lawyer here in Salem, and I represent the Oregon Bankers Association. And I was very privileged to be involved in this work group and to be responsible for pulling together the various ideas and to actually put the draft together. So if you don't like the words on the page, you can shake your finger at me. This bill, as Representative Butler said, has been a long time coming, and it's been a subject of some discussion for two or three sessions. And the basic driving force, I think, is that no one, not the banks, not the public officials, not the treasurer, no one is really very happy with the existing rules of Chapter 295 on how we collateralize public fund deposits. Just a very brief primer. Of course, any depositor's deposit is insured by the FDIC up to the first $100,000. But we all know that we've got lots of public local governments and state governments out there that are putting millions of dollars in the banks, and we have to have some means of providing protection for those dollars so that if something goes haywire in the bank, those public funds are not going to be lost. And the way we've had that historically is by putting up collateral, by actually having financial institutions pledge securities that they invest in their normal operations. They pledge those to a custodian, they're overseen by a pool manager, and that's the way we have provided that security for those public funds, so that if there is a problem with the bank, that collateral is there. One of the problems is that the collateral level under the current law is only 25%, and if you had, you know, the worst case scenario where a larger bank that had a lot of public funds went down, then only the first 25% of those would typically be collateralized. There is a provision in the existing law that allows the collateral level to be kicked up to 110% of the public funds on deposit, but if that isn't activated before the bank gets into trouble, then you can have a problem. So that's one of the problems. Another problem is that the amount of public funds that are in any institution or coming from any one local government at any one time can fluctuate enormously widely. With tax revenues coming in, payrolls going out, you can have just huge dips and mountains in that. And so everyone involved in this is involved in a very labor-intensive and kind of risk-sensitive environment of having to monitor the amount of collateral that's posted at any one time to make sure that it matches up with the amount of public funds and that the statutes are complied with. So the members of this work group started long before I got involved to look around for other models, and they found that the state of Washington had done something about 25 years ago that has worked very satisfactorily up there. They've created what I call a virtual collateral pool, where each financial institution, as in our system, pledges collateral into a custodian, and it's actually held by the custodian. But then that collateral is there not only to collateralize the public funds that are taken in by that institution, but also to as backup collateral for the public funds that are taken by all of the other institutions that are participating in this. So we have this pool of collateral, which creates a lot more security, and it eliminates the need to do this daily gyration. And that's really the guts of it. I put together, I think, 5 or 6 pages of testimony that gives you the highlights of the bill. I've also prepared a section-by-section review of the bill, which is attached to my testimony. And there's a lot more detail than I'm going to bore you with today in those materials. At this point, I think it's more important that the lawyers stop talking and you hear from the people who really have to deal with this program on the ground. So at this point, I will stop, and I'll be happy to answer any questions either now or when we get done with all of our testimony.
Great.
I will go next.
Hello, my name is Sherry Anderson, and I am the treasurer for Clackamas County, located outside of the Portland metropolitan area. Clackamas County is a large urban county, and one of the problems that we have with the current collateralization is our exposure. And that was what drove me as a representative of Clackamas County and Clackamas County itself, this is on their legislative agenda, to seek some kind of answer to the issues that we saw. I prepared this one-page little example, and in this example, I used the city of Oregon City, which is one of the small municipalities in our county. And I give you an example: if they were to have $2.1 million in their checking account and the bank were to suffer a sudden and unforeseen loss, that they would lose, under the current collateralization system, $1.5 million of that $2.1 million. So in the city of Oregon City, if they were to have that happen, they would lose $1.5 million. Why this is so important to the County Treasurer's Association is because we handle the tax collections. Counties, by their nature, are typically larger than cities. It is not uncommon for us on November 15th to have $250 million in a checking account at the bank. So if this was to happen at the county level, at a time when we had huge balances in those banks, we would suffer a catastrophic loss that would probably force us into bankruptcy, especially since most of those funds are held in trust for other entities like fire districts and school districts. And all of those districts within our county, we hold those funds in trust. So this is of particular importance to counties because of the large volumes that we hold in our accounts. And I think that while those things have not happened, there is always the potential, and that's what we're trying to eliminate as our exposure to that potential. One other important aspect of the current statute is, and Ken mentioned, we have to estimate what we think our highest balance is. So if we think during tax collection our highest balance will be $250 million, we will fill out a request for $250 million worth of collateral at 25%. So we tell them we're going to have $250 million. They post 25% collateral. Well, if we were, let's say somebody did a transmission, a tape transmission of their tax deposit for $10 million that we didn't anticipate coming in, and we were at $260 million, and the bank were to default, me, Sherry Anderson, personally, as Clackamas County Treasurer, could be held responsible for that $10 million that I failed to estimate correctly. So there's a personal liability for the public officials that exists if we do not estimate those balances correctly under the current legislation. So that was another thing that we wanted to see changed. And the final thing that was important to the public depositors is the disclosure aspects. When we do our financial statements, disclosing, as an example, we had $75 million in bank accounts at the end of the fiscal year, June 30th of 2006. and the disclosure in our financial statements that goes to all of our bonders, all of the people who, you know, loan us money or invest somehow in Clackamas County, that we have $53 million that is uncollateralized and unprotected. While we know that, you know, the likelihood we choose our banks wisely and we invest wisely, but, you know, we would like to see a pooled collateral approach because it changes our disclosure. All of our funds under the disclosure requirements would be considered collateralized. And so, briefly, that is the things that I believe that the public depositors, especially on the county level, are looking for in this and have gotten.
Correct.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Chairman Schauffler, my name is Lark Weisham. I am Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of Citizens Bank in Corvallis, Oregon. I also serve as Vice Chair of the Oregon Bankers Association and also a member of their Financial Committee. Citizens Bank is a $350 million, 50-year-old community bank in Corvallis, Oregon, and we take public deposits. Public deposits are an important part of our deposit base for our community. I'm here in support of HB 2901. As you have heard, this bill provides for greater protection of public deposits, yet it also modernizes Oregon's collateralization program, which you've heard from Sherry can be quite onerous and at times very inefficient. As a work group, we spent probably 15 months in this current work group working on this legislation, and I can tell you it was a very collaborative group. We looked at both sides of risk, both sides of challenges, and we think we come up with a bill that takes into account the unique needs of not only the public depositors, but bank depositories, both large and small. And we're in a shared risk pool with very large banks and very small community banks, and yet I feel what we've drafted protects both the large and the small bank and the public entities. When I started working on this group, one thing I wanted to make sure of is that protection, that we mitigated risk. And we built into that program a shared liability program that helps all of us. If you are undercapitalized bank, you're going to have to pledge more collateral than a well-capitalized bank. And we built that tiered protection for all of us in that program. We have, in today's banking industry, we have ways to measure our collateral. We have ways to measure our capital, and we can present that information to the state treasurer, and then we pledge collateral based on how well capitalized our institution is. With this bill, deposits are better protected for the public. Deposits from our, as I said, public entities are very important to the banking industry. We feel with this bill, those funds are better protected. And as a bank, we feel the shared liability, we're also protected against any issues. So I would entertain any questions that you have.
Thank you, and thank all of you. And committee members, I just want to, you know, we have a big, long agenda today. If you have some brief questions, there's no problem. I have no problem with that today, but we don't have the draft of the amendment in front of us. I know Mr. Martinez is in the building almost every day, if not every day. We'll just keep in mind the time. So, are there any questions to this panel today? Representative Berger.
No questions, just a thank you to Mr. Sherman for coming. He's an old friend.
Yeah, very good. Any more? I just want to thank my county treasurer for driving clear on down here and all the fine work she does. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. All righty then. Bridget O'Callaghan and Kristen Goodman.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I have prepared some testimony that she is distributing at the moment. I'm just going to give you the highlights of that in the interest of time this afternoon.
Before you get started, you have to identify yourself.
Sure. For the record, my name is Bridget O'Callaghan, and I'm a Vice President and Western Group Manager for U.S. Bank's Government Banking Division in Portland. In addition to my role in Portland, I also manage U.S. Bank's government banking teams in 12 Western states and was actively involved with the work group that put this particular bill together. I am here today in support of House Bill 2901. in that it simplifies the existing process that we have in place today. In my current role at U.S. Bank, I've had the opportunity to work with many the collateral programs for many Western states, and have had the opportunity to understand that some of them can be more challenging than others. And Oregon's, at the present time, tends to be fairly cumbersome. It's cumbersome in terms of what's required of the bank to provide, but it's also cumbersome for the local governments, because it is the local government's responsibility to notify the bank of the amount that should be pledged on behalf of their deposits. We work very closely with those local governments, and it is the department that I manage that would be directly impacted by this bill. I'm in support of this particular bill because it outlines a straightforward pool concept with reasonable reporting requirements. Under the current program, as was described earlier, if a financial institution were to fail, they would look first to the FDIC insurance, then to the collateral that's pledged on behalf of those local governments. But the actual collection for that local government is based upon the lesser of their actual balances or 25% of the face value of their collateral certificate. Under the new program, we would have more of a correlation to the actual balances that are maintained by...
Bridget, let me get in here. People, you got to shut your phones off, your pagers. And anybody caught doing it has to pay a fine of $100.
No, to the Business and Labor Donut
Fund. I'm just joking about the fund. Carry on, Bridget. Forgive me for interrupting.
You can only take 10, you know.
My point is that the current program has the amount that a bank pledges to protect the public funds in the state of Oregon has little correlation to the actual balances that are on deposit. The new program would mesh those balances more appropriately and be a more streamlined system for a bank to manage, as well as for a local government to stay within compliance and manage as well.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and Committee. My name is Kristen Goodhue, and I'm the Treasury and Investment Analyst for the City of Salem. So I'm one of these hands-on people that has to manage this process day to day. From my perspective and from the City's perspective, we are very much in support of this bill, as it would mitigate some of the time and energy necessary to manage this process on an annual basis, and also it would provide us with an opportunity to be more transparent in our reporting. Currently, we're forced to report all of the deposits that are outside of the FDIC insurance, as well as the 25% that is actually collateralized. We're forced to represent the rest of that money as uncollateralized, and when in fact it's not uncollateralized, it's collateralized to the full extent of the lot at present. So really, this would aid us in being able to communicate to our constituency that we are being as responsible with municipal funds as possible. So that would be a major benefit. And furthermore, this is really a win-win situation here, because the banks are satisfied. They're able to be a bit more in control of their assets and more fiscally responsible by not being forced to park a large sum of funds in the collateral pool, which is earning a lower yield than they would elsewise earn. Therefore, it really makes sense from the bank's perspective. It makes sense from our perspective. It shifts the responsibility of tracking our daily deposits and reporting that information to the banks. And so really, it's a win-win, and that's the message that I'd like to convey today.
Thank you. Any questions? Very good. I'm going to charge Mr. Martinez to come around and make sure the committee's comfortable with all of Mr. Sherman's testimony here. There are things going on here, and I just want to make sure everybody's comfortable with it. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all I have signed up. Would anyone else like to testify to House Bill 2901 today? And we will be bringing this bill back. So just first to public hearing. Seeing no one else, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2901 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2443.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 24443 is sponsored by Representative Lim. It requires that before the Oregon Liquor Control Commission issue a new off-premise sales license whose business location is within 500 feet of a business that currently holds a off-premise sales license with five or fewer employees, that the commission prepare and makes available an impact statement that reflects the anticipated economic effect of the new business on the existing licensed business, including the loss of revenues from sales of alcoholic beverages and other merchandise sold at the existing business.
Very good. Representative Lim.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
We passed a good beacon bill on the floor this morning. I'm
thank
proud
you
to
very
say
much
I
for your
sponsored
support.
It with
and
you.
It was very close, but we were able to pass it.
And we just want to know, Senator, do you have your beacon with you today?
I have a beacon off my head. Okay. Chair Schaffler and members of the committee, especially I want to thank you for hearing House Bill 2443. For the records, my name is John Lim, state representative from Gresham District 50. And this House Bill 2443, the director of OLCC expressed some concern as we discussed on this issue yesterday. So we have agreed that the bill as it is written, it might not work well. So we are working with the director of OLCC of possibly a new language. So when we do that, we like to hopefully come back and like to have another public hearing with your permission. So that is the current situation. And so I just want to give you the report what happened.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative. Are there any questions of Representative Lim? All right. Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
Let us know what we can do.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone else today who would like to testify to House Bill 2443? All right. Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2443, and I'm going to go out of order again, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2490.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2490 is sponsored by Vice Chair Esquivel. We had the first hearing on this measure on February 28th. It prohibits escrow agents from imposing requirements that delay disbursement of funds and property, what is known as earnest money. And you have a -1 amendment in front of you from Vice Chair Esquivel, in which the language was discussed at the first hearing.
Very good. Representative Esquivel and Alan Brickley.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6. As we discussed prior to in the other public hearing on this particular bill, 2490, it outlines the disbursement of earnest money in a contractual agreement, and it doesn't get fluid with the disbursement process through escrow with the escrow officers and the lender. And that's what was being put together. So this separates the two, and it makes it mandatory that escrow officers go ahead and disperse after both principals involved so designate to escrow that they shall disperse according to their wishes. So, and we have amendments here, and I'm going to turn this over to Alan Brickley and let him go through the amendments, but I think they look fine with me.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Alan Brickley. I am a counsel with First American Title Insurance Company offices at 222 Southwest Columbia Street in Portland, Oregon. I'm here also representing the Oregon Land Title Association. And just very briefly, the purpose for the amendments are to recognize a competing bill or portion of the statute, I should say, which relates to a different set of instructions to the escrow agent for disbursement of earnest money. And then the other two parts of it simply relate to the process by which an escrow agent may more safely disperse these funds. The third part prevents the escrow agent from imposing additional requirements on the principals. This is designed largely to take away the responsibility or the ability, I should say, of an escrow agent to release, ask for or require a release of liability from the parties before they give up the money. So essentially, in the form with the amendments. The Oregon Land Title Association is very comfortable with this. I think it'll work to the benefit both of the title companies and, more importantly, for the consumers who want to get their money back as quickly as possible.
Thank you, gentlemen. Are there any questions? All right. Well, thank you very much. I don't see anyone else signed up. This is the second public hearing on this, and we intend to work this today. Would anyone else like to testify to House Bill 2490? All right, seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2490. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2490. Representative Escobar.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to 2490.
Representative Escobar moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2490. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ruled. Representative Escobar.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we move 2490 as amended to the House floor with a Duplass recommendation.
Representative Escobar moves House Bill 2490 as to the floor as amended to the floor with a Duplass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right, Kristen, please.
Representative Edwards.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Escobar.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Aye.
Representative
excuse me.
Representative.
Aye.
Chair Shockley.
Aye. Representative, would you like to carry the bill on the floor?
Yes, sir, I shall.
Very good. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2490 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2712. And 2713.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, both House Bill 2712 and 2713 are both sponsored by Representative Patty Smith at the request of the Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon. House Bill 2712 creates an interim task force on land divisions directed to make recommendations on improving the process for our subdividing and partitioning land. The measure establishes the membership of the task force, who is responsible for appointing members, and there's a sunset on the task force on the opening day of the 75th legislative session, and there's an emergency clause on the measure. House Bill 2713 prohibits the placement of public or private utility easement within 1 foot of a survey monument on a subdivision or partition plat, and also includes private utility in the definition of a utility or private utility infrastructure into the definition of a utility easement. And there's a Dash 1 amendment in front of me, which the proponents will explain.
All right. Thank you, Teresa. There's some overlap in testimony to both these bills. That's why I opened both. Please be clear which bill you're testifying to for the chair's benefit, because he tends to get confused at times. I try not to do this, but today I said I would. So I'm going to call Dan Linshed, forgive me, sir, and Chris Pearson and Sarah Myers. Please.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Maybe I was wrong, but did you say that we had a Dash 1 amendment on 12?
Yes, Mr. Chair. There should, yes. Is there not one?
Well, Representative Bergen, I don't
excuse
have
me, it. It's on 13.
Or 13, excuse me. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry, Representative.
We have 13.
Yes, we have 13. There is no amendment in front of you on 12. I apologize.
Good. Just go ahead, Sarah. Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Shoffler, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Myers, here today representing the Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon. With me today are Dan Linshide from Yamhill County and Chuck Pearson from Clackamas Counties. House Bills 2713 and 2712 address both a short-term and a long-term solution to current problems related to land partitions, property line adjustments, and monuments. House Bill 2713 provides for a change to the statutory definition of partition land necessary to address problems in complying with current language that prohibits the creation of less than two parcels in the partitioning process. Additionally, the bill addresses the need to recognize private utilities that are involved in the placement of utility infrastructures adjacent to survey monuments. And finally, the bill addresses the matter of disturbing a monument placement by utilities by establishing a one-foot buffer. We recognize that the recommendations are not permanent fixes to the more broad solution necessary to remedying overall changes necessary to Chapter 92. House Bill 2713 provides for an interim solution to working with one of the many difficulties faced by surveyors and one that will provide greater flexibility until such time as stakeholders can review the changes and can be achieved by a more comprehensive review of ORS 92, which is envisioned in House Bill 2712, the bill that establishes the task force. At this point, I'll turn it over to the gentlemen to my left and right, to as the certified experts, to present their testimony and perspectives regarding the proposed solutions and to answer any questions that you may have. With respect to, as Teresa mentioned, the Dash 1 Amendment to 2713, it is, as I would call, a simple change related to the one-foot buffer. It changes the language from utility easement to, say, utility infrastructure.
Representative Chair Schaffler, excuse me, and members of the committee, my name is Chuck Pearson. I'm actually here representing the Oregon Association of County Engineers and Surveyors, who is in support of both of these bills. House Bill 2712 creates a task force to remedy many of the problems that are currently we're dealing with on a statewide basis. Different jurisdictions, different counties have different ways of addressing things, and all of the 200-plus cities in Oregon have different ways. So it's a real mishmash, and it's a significant problem for the public and for surveyors that are doing work within multiple jurisdictions. House Bill 2713 is really pretty simple. It does two things other than the private easement addition to it. It creates a definition of partition plat to allow the creation, if you will, of one parcel, which will assist in legitimizing the serious problem that's arisen in Oregon over the illegal lot. Right now, there is no provision to, if somebody unlawfully creates a parcel, to fix that legally if you have two pieces and one person wants to, doesn't want to participate in a plat, then the other person is actually, you know, dead in the water, can't do anything. The second part about the utility infrastructure, there is only one place in the face of this earth where you can put a property corner. State law specifies what those corners shall be. They're typically 30-inch iron rods or iron pipes. And when you place a utility line, a power line or a gas line underneath one, then the surveyor drives the iron. There's some serious problems, and there have been some serious injuries. And we're just attempting to correct that. We aren't saying that the easement can't be next to the property line. We're just saying let's keep the infrastructure, the lines and the pipes, away by 1 foot. It's a very simple fix, and it's a safety concern, and it's a savings to the property owners by not having to continually repay to have their corners reestablished. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'll turn it over to Mr. Lindschein.
Go ahead, sir, and then we'll open questions.
Chair Schaffer, committee members, Dan Lindschein, chair of the Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon, and also Yamhill County Surveyor. And I think Mr. Pearson has covered most of the bases here. I think the two bills are pretty interrelated, though, and that's a pretty critical part that I would stress for you. If you have any questions, more than happy to answer.
Thank you. Representative Esquivel?
Yes, I've been involved in some ugly ones down in Jackson County. In fact, we have an individual that owns 20, 30 acres, whatever it is, and somebody at one time had partitioned off a two-acre piece or something like that illegally. They had run a residence, and they built a residence, did this whole thing, and of course it's illegal. Now he's encumbered, of course, by a problem. He's got a clobbered title. I think looking at it in his eyes, I think the simplest way to alleviate this problem is to ensure that the county clerks, before they record this document, because they have to record the document, usually, that they have to go through a planning process and be signed off by planning and the assessor as well. Because those three in Jackson County do not speak to one another. That's how we arrived at these problems. And that's a fact. So we need to have some way, some vehicle to get these three entities together to get on the same page. Because if it doesn't go through the planning process and it's an illegal partition, planning can red flag that. Then the county recorder would not, of course, record it, and the assessor would not get it on the tax roll.
All right. Go ahead, sir.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Esquivel, that sounds more like a statement rather than a question, but I will just try to respond to that by saying that House Bill 2712 is the vehicle that we would use to ultimately resolve those issues. I share your angst in this. It's a serious problem all over the state, and so many counties and cities do things so much differently. We just can't deal with it on a piecemeal basis like we have been trying to do in the past.
Yeah, this issue's not unique to where you live, Representative. Representative Berger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of comments. One, in conversation with the proponents of this bill, I have suggested, and they have been very gracious in agreeing that this task force ought to have private developer as part of it, somebody who works from the private side on these kinds of partitions. I would also like to say that this task force, I hope they can come to terms, because I'm well aware of what a mess this is. It's sort of unfortunate but realistic that there's nothing in this bill that makes the county say, okay, we've got recommendations, now we have to do it. But I think that if they come up with some decent and serious recommendations and that are workable, that it will get there in terms of the counties coming together. And if not, I'll be watching next session.
Any more questions for these folks? All righty then. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I'm going to call Linda Ludwig from League of Oregon Cities, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. Pleasure to be before this committee today. And just want to give you a couple of quick words. We broadly support 2712 and the Task Force on Land Division. We think that's a very, very important component with these issues. In terms of 2713, we do have cities that have some concerns about the bill, and we have some that broadly support it. So I would like to lend my support to the bill today with the thought that any reservations that cities have, if we do go forward and pass 2712, they could be brought up in that venue.
Is that it? That's any representative it? Of Ms. Any questions of Ms. Ludwig? All righty then. We're
Thank
just going
to
have a first hearing today. Representative Smith is one of ours. Thank you. I'm going to call Chris Crean and Steve Kafori, please. Hello, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafori. I'm here this afternoon representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. We're about 1,000 members statewide who represent planning commissioners who are lay citizens, land use planners, and land use attorneys. And our goal at the legislature is to help ensure that the bills this legislature passes out comport to good planning principles. I have with me today Chris Crean. He may look like a familiar face to some of you. He served as member of Legislative Council for a number of years doing land use drafting. He's a member of our Legislative Committee. Mr. Crean.
Thank you, Chair Schaffler, members of the committee. I'll keep this brief. I was not aware when I came down that there was a Dash 1 amendment. It looks like from the Dash 1 amendment it addresses our concerns.
Sir, you're for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's correct. For the record, Chris Crane, on behalf of the Oregon Chapter of the American Planning Association. I handed out to you a sample plat that is under consideration in a land use local land use proceeding right now. And you can see pages 1 and 2, you're taking a property and dividing it into three parcels. And just looking at page 1, there along the southern edge of the parkway is the solid line is the property line. And just below that, the dotted line shows the easement. Well, of course, pipes for things like stormwater, sanitary sewer, potable water are straight. It's very difficult to lay them in curves. So utility easements are typically very straight. If you couldn't put utility easement next to a monument, you either would have a little bump out in your easements around each one of those monuments, which is a problem with straight pipes, or you'd have to pull the whole easement back a foot from the property line, creating essentially, effectively, an 11-foot easement rather than a 10-foot easement, and thereby reducing the building envelope. On this, I mean, just looking at parcel 3.1 there, that's it's about 130 feet there, so you'd lose 130 feet of the buildable area of that lot if you couldn't put the utility easement within 1 foot of the monument. The -1 amendment changes that to the utility infrastructure, so you couldn't put the actual pipe within 1 foot of the monument, and that may address our concerns. I was pleased to hear Chair Schaffler say that the bill will be back in front of you, because I would like the opportunity to run this amendment past the members of our committee and make sure that everybody's okay with it. On 2712, I agree, it's probably a good idea. I remember the headaches I used to have when I was drafting statutes for committees like this, and we try to come up with a definition of property created by subdivision or partition or by foreclosure under 215, 283, or by a land sale contract recorded prior to, or there's just so many different ways that you create units of land, and it's complicated, and mistakes get made, and people end up with the kinds of problems that Representative Escobar described. So I think it's an important effort, and I encourage you to go forward with it, and I would also echo Representative Berger's comments. When I left Legislative Council, I joined Miller Nash, where I did represent private development interests, and I think it would be a good idea to have such an interest on that committee. With that, I will end my testimony and be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions, these gentlemen? All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
All right. This is the first public hearing for House Bills 2712 and 2713. I don't have anyone else signed up to testify today. Would anyone like to testify? All right, seeing no one, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2712 and on House Bill 2713. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2795.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2795 is sponsored by Vice Chair Holvey. It requires the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to audit information that is used to determine prevailing wage rates. And it also modifies the minimum and maximum limits to the fee that is paid by contractors on public works contracts to offset the cost that is incurred in determining the prevailing wage rate and the audit process.
Thank you. Dan Gardner, Jessica Adamson, and Jeff Dean. Oh, forgive me, Representative. You snuck around on me. Representative,
I'm trying to be quick.
You weren't on the list, Representative. Go ahead, Representative. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm just going to give a brief little intro to why this particular bill. It's got a couple of different purposes, but, you know, we establish prevailing wage rates in this state, and the commissioner does a lot of work in putting these rates out, and oftentimes people are a little disgruntled about the rates, and I have heard from both sides of, from labor side, from management side, from contractors, from public officials, somewhat disgruntled about the rates, how did we get this rate and everything else, And so quite frankly, I looked into it a little bit and, you know, find out that the Employment Department does the surveys and the commissioner then publishes the rates. And though he may be able to actually audit these rates right now, the second part of this bill is actually aimed at making sure he has the funds to actually do some of that work. I think it is important that we go back and sometimes look at how the rates were established and look at the data to make sure it's accurate, to make sure that the participants that are submitting valid data into these rates. I don't believe that that's, you know, happening right now. I don't know when the last time an audit was actually done of the data that goes into establishing these rates. And I think it would be good for Boley, and it would be good for the Employment Department, and it would be good for the private sector and the public sector to have some sort of assurance that we do have checks on how we're establishing these rates. That's just simply the idea of doing this. And also, I wanted to make sure that in this bill that the Boley or the commissioner, when they audit these rates, they're trained to see the certified payrolls to be able to identify the wage classifications and things like that, and they're very familiar with that. And I think it's important that they be able to get the data that they need, the surveys, the certified payrolls, if they need those, from the Employment Department, that there is no confidentiality standing in the way. Not saying that that always exists, but we run into those sorts of issues on a lot of things. And as you know, we've heard some testimony about confidentiality of employment data, and I just wanted to make sure that we have the ability to check up on these rates periodically. It doesn't say they have to audit any specific number. of rates or any specific data or any specific wages, but certainly I want that ability to be there, and I would like to see it actually happen once in a while so we have some confidence that the rates that are being established are accurate. I think this would be good for the public sector, the private sector, and everybody concerned in this arena, and dispel some of the people's doubt about the accuracy of these rates, because I think they are important to everybody involved. The fee that's in this bill that's just raising the threshold hasn't been raised in quite some time. And, it's been my opinion anyway, maybe not shared by everybody, but the Bureau of Labor and Industries has not really gotten the kinds of funding that they need to really do not that they don't do a great job, but to do a better job than what's happening right now. And I think this represents a better job. That's essentially the basis of it, and I invite the others to come up and talk about it. I know some don't think this is necessary. They already have the authority to do it, but I'm not sure they have the FTE or the ability to actually do it, and I want to make sure the Employment Department and BOLI cooperate in making sure these rates are established, they're fair, they're accurate, and be good for all of us.
Thank you, Representative, and I couldn't agree more in making sure we're applying the accurate rates. If we could just make it as simple to determine what the accurate rates are as where prevailing wage triggers, we'd have it made. I guess we all missed that.
Would you like me to address that, too?
Yes, sir. We're going to get on that right quick. Any questions of Representative Holey? All right. Thank you, sir. Dan Gardner, Jessica Adamson, Jeff Dean, please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And I'm pleased to be here today to testify on House Bill 2795. As Representative Holvey stated, there are actually two parts to this bill. The first part, requires audits of the prevailing wage survey. I have to tell you, I've heard this for quite some time, both from Union and OpenShop, that they actually do want us to go out and actually verify that, in fact, the information that a contractor is sending in to us is completely accurate. We've heard complaints from some folks that they believe that a particular contractor who may be housed in Eugene, for instance, would report all their hours in that particular region, not in every region that they work in. Whether they do or don't without actually auditing that function, I'm not sure that we'd know for sure. I can tell you that I believe the survey is correct as it can be in its current form, and that it might be good to do an occasional audit of different contractors on this. It is something I'd have to take up with the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee and discuss with them as well how to go about it fairly and accurately. The second half of the bill deals with a rate increase. The Prevailing Wage Fund was established in 1995 when we first started doing the survey. It is 0.001% of a prevailing wage project with a minimum of $100 payment, maximum of $5,000 payment. As you can see from the chart attached to my testimony, it'll show you that the projected fund ending balance at the end of this, at the conclusion of the 07-09 biennium, will be $271,256. In addition, it projects a negative balance of $254,000 at the end of the 09-11 budget. There's actually several reasons for this, for why the drains on the fund have been greater recently. There's about four different issues that have come up. One was an 8.5-month task force on public-private partnership. There were costs related to that. There's also, we've shifted the agency from being a complaint-driven agency to being a predetermination agency. One of the things that we're most concerned about is when we get complaints, it could be at the beginning of a project, the middle, it could be at the end, it could be within 180 days after completion. And I think it's fair to know going in whether it's prevailing wage or not. So where we used to get about 2 predeterminations per year, we now get close to 100 per year. We've actually went to the emergency board last interim, got an extra position funded out of the prevailing wage fund for that position to solely do predeterminations. So there have been additional costs to the fund in doing that. One other reason is during the downturn economic times of the last 2 biennium, one of the things in order to keep people within the agency and reduce infrastructure, one of the things I did was shift some of the administrative costs, like the head of the wage and hour division, part of her time to prevailing wage, which clearly was used for prevailing wage, and other administrative costs as well. Those have drained the fund to some degree as well. The fourth thing would be that of attorney's fees. Attorney's fees have greatly increased over the last biennium, particularly partly because of an 8.5-month task force and the Department of Justice advice there, partly because we had the Department of Justice go double-check our predeterminations, and partly because of some of the litigation that's been out there on, ongoing, for especially for public-private partnerships. So those are the two parts to the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson, here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. With respect to the fee, which I'll start with first, our association has taken a position that we can support the fee with a few caveats. First, with a sunset on the fee, we recognize that the predeterminations, which hopefully will come to somewhat of a minimum once the public-private partnerships bill has been passed. In addition, the task force preferably won't meet again. That was a great experience that we're glad we're done with. And then hopefully with the experiences being gained, we can see less money being spent on the Attorney General's fees, in addition to hopefully less litigation. Those factors together should reduce the drain on the fund. With that respect, we believe that if we can limit it to 3 years, so that creates a cushion. In our discussions with the Bureau, they've indicated that that would be the case, and that after that period of time that we should be able to reduce the fee back to what it is today. Additionally, contractors would like to see the public agencies paying this fee directly. The reality is that, like all portions of a contract, we have markup involved in that. It is a frustrating process. The agency knows directly how much the contract is. They already have to submit paperwork to BOLI indicating that a contract has been awarded. We believe at that time they could simply cut a check for the fee and pay it directly, as opposed to having the contractor pay it to the public agency. When we pay that fee, we have a markup on it between 1% to 15% in profit that we assess in addition to that, so that that's what the public agency is paying. We believe they will end up paying less by paying that fee directly. The Bureau has indicated to us that they have no particular heartburn about that as long as they get the money. We can understand that. As it relates to the audit portion of the bill, I think having sat on the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee at our last meeting, we had a conversation about that section of the bill. And while there was no position taken, I think it's fair to say that there were concerns raised by a wide variety of us about that particular portion of the bill, and I think that we would agree that before an audit should be undertaken, that we would like to have additional conversations about the structure and the purpose and what we're trying to get out of that. So I guess at this point in time, we would ask for that portion of the bill to be removed and to have the conversation in the interim about what that might look like, knowing that the commissioner has the authority today to look at some of that, and through a collaborative process, we could look at whether that's and under what conditions that would occur.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Dean with Associated Builders and Contractors. I, too, signed in to get us on the record regarding this bill. We don't have an official position on it, although we would concur with the concerns dealing with Section 6 and the auditing language that are in this bill. After doing this job for 3 years and working with the commissioner, we know the extent to which those wages are determined right now, the survey that is done, as well as some of the reporting that's required of contractors. So we would like to continue the conversation with that. We have representation on the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee, and again, we'd like to just further discuss the need for this portion of the bill before it gets put into law. Regarding the increase in the fee, we're okay with that. We would agree. I think if there's one thing that we all want right now is that is more predeterminations on prevailing wage projects. Contractors that are going on these works need to know up front whether or not it's going to be prevailing wage or not. That said, we too think that it would make sense to have the local governments pay this fee up front rather than essentially requiring two checks to be cut. One is the public agency cutting a check to the contractor. The contractor then is writing a check to Boley. So we think that would streamline the process and would be very supportive of that amendment.
And thank you all. I'm convinced we can avoid litigation and in the future by a vehicle we're going to be hearing here soon, and I look forward to that. I'm convinced it can work. And but on all that, I'd like to open up questions to these nice folks. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, has anyone seen or contemplated of the three of the panel before us what language that might look like if you were to go as you suggest, or what are the pros and cons from Mr. Gardner's point of view of letting the local governments do this? And another question while they're talking is, would somebody go through again that piece about we want a sunset on this because it's a short-term problem?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I apologize for not mentioning that in my first comments. That is my agreement with the related parties, both with AGC, ABC, and Building Trades, is to make sure that it's a temporary short-term problem to have enough cash in the fund. I would not want to see the fund build up to where there's an excess in it, and that's why we'd only do a sunset for two biennium, and it would revert back to the $100, $5,000.
Is that in this language?
I don't believe it's currently in language. We're having amendment drafted to do that. And the other piece you were asking about was...
Well, Ms. Adamson mentioned local government, both these people mentioned local government paying this instead of the contractor directly. What's the problem with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, at our last Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee meeting, that was brought up. A lot of the committee members felt that would be the appropriate way to do it. It'd actually save local government money by reducing that markup cost. The representatives there from local government, both from the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties, felt their organizations would rather not have to do that. However, they were willing to send two representatives to a League of Oregon Cities meeting and an Association of Oregon Counties meeting to further discuss it. Those meetings, to the best of my knowledge, have not taken place yet, and we're trying to get to that point where they understand that actually the local governments understand that the contractors feel that this would actually reduce local government cost.
So, Mr. Chair, I guess the question for you is... are we going to be waiting on some of these amendments and some of these other things?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you. I'll reserve comments till I see amendments.
Confident these nice people will be working with a good representative here and hopefully get something squared away. Any other questions? All right. Very good. Thank you very much. I don't see anyone else signed up to testify on House Bill 2795. Would anyone else like to do so? We will be hearing this again, I believe. So we've got another shot at it. I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2795, and I'm going to go out of order again because I only have one person right now signed up for House Bill 20. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2541.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2541 is a committee bill of ours at the request of the Oregon Association of Realtors. It limits the authority of a city or county to impose a business license tax on certain licensees of the real estate agency. And you have in front of you a dash one amendment from the realtors. It modifies the language on who would be exempt from the tax. To a principal real estate broker, unless the real estate broker or the principal real estate broker maintains a place of business within the county or city imposing or collecting the tax.
Very good. Harlan Levy, please. And Harlan, would you go over the amendments for us too, please?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Esquivel, members of the committee.
I'm crossing things off, Mr. Levy.
For the record, my name is Harlan Levy, here representing the Oregon Association of Realtors, here to support House Bill 2541 and specifically the -1 amendments to House Bill 2541, which pretty much replaced the bill. The -1 amendments do what we had intended the bill to do. The amendment that was, or the bill as drafted, does not quite get us to what we wanted. This bill is a bill about fairness. Current law does not prohibit local jurisdictions from assessing business license taxes on real estate licensees when they have no physical presence in the jurisdiction assessing the fee. Some jurisdictions have actually been assessing this tax on real estate licensees when they list a single house within the jurisdiction, regardless of where their physical office may be located. Real estate licensees are easy targets for this type of practice, as you might imagine, because their listings are on the internet, are in the newspaper, and in many cases on the front lawns of the properties themselves. They have a for sale sign posted. What this bill says is that cities and counties are allowed to assess business license taxes on these real estate licensees if they maintain a place of business within the jurisdiction. And place of business does include both main and branch offices. So what we're talking about here is a physical presence. We believe this is fair because it requires the licensee to pay the tax where they're actually conducting the business, and it prevents multiple taxation. And that's an important point here. A real estate license is issued by the state of Oregon, and it allows the licensee to practice law anywhere, or excuse me, practice real estate anywhere in the state of Oregon. A real estate licensee has to pay the $230 fee every 2 years to maintain this license, as well as some additional fees that I've listed in my testimony. With over 240 cities and 36 counties in Oregon, if every jurisdiction were able to assess this fee as they currently are, it would make statewide practice of real estate nearly impossible. It would become cost prohibitive, and that would be a problem not just for real estate licensees, but also for consumers. Real estate licensees are in a competitive business with one another, and that's good for the consumers. The commission that a licensee charges a consumer is negotiable, and it allows consumers to shop around for services and for the best value for their dollar. We think that this bill is necessary because it would protect that consumer ability to shop around and maintain real estate license as a statewide activity. Finally, we would respectfully request that you adopt this bill with the -1 amendment and move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Levy? Well, you've done a great job, Harlan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Would anyone else, no one else has signed up to testify to House Bill 2541. Would anyone like to testify? Seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2541. And committee, do you feel comfortable moving this today? I will open a work session on House Bill 2541. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, I think, first of all, I probably have to declare a conflict of interest since I am a realtor, although this actually stemmed from the city of Medford's, in my opinion, misuse of their ordinance. They literally had someone in their finance department going through the classified ads, and if you were a realtor and you had a listing that you were advertising, they would send you an $85 bill and go after you. That's what started this. Now, I don't mind giving the city of Medford my taxes, my business taxes, because I have an office in Medford. But I have worked very hard, and it's been very costly. I believe it's a couple $1,000 just to get into the real estate profession. Plus, I pay yearly, like Mr. Levy was saying. Plus, I do 30 hours continuing ed. And it all adds up to a very substantial amount of money per year in order to sell real estate anywhere in the state of Oregon. The inequity here is if I, as a realtor, represented a buyer within the city limits, I wouldn't have to pay it. But yet if I represent a seller, I have to pay it. So it's very interesting inequity in this whole system, but hopefully we'll get this behind us, and I would like to work on this again next session to broaden the scope of it.
Is that a motion, Representative?
No, actually, I'll move. I'll take the motion of adopting a -1 amendment to 2541.
Very good. Representative moves we adopt the -1 amendment to House Bill 2541. Is there discussion? Is there any objection? So moved. Representative Escobar.
Yes. So, Mr. Chair, I move that we send 2541 to the House floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Very good. Representative Escobar moves House Bill 2541 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? All right. Kristen?
Representative
Leverett.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Escobar.
Aye.
Vice Chair Holden.
Aye.
Vice Chair Holden.
Excuse
me.
Aye.
Aye. Representative, would you like to carry this bill?
I'd love to.
I know we can put a lot of work on you today, but I think you should carry it. Very good. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2541. And thank you for your patience on the folks that are waiting for a public hearing on House Bill 2756.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2756 is a committee bill at the request of the Management Labor Advisory Committee. It changes the time frame for the provisions of compensable medical treatment within the workers' compensation system by physician assistants, naturopaths, podiatrists, and chiropractors. You have in front of you, committee members, a -2 amendment from the Workers' Compensation Division, which outlines the time frames for each care provider group that's included in the measure. It requires medical service providers to certify with to the Department of Consumer and Business Services that they have read informational materials provided by DCBS regarding the workers' compensation system and the new provisions under the measure, and also adds an emergency clause effective on passage.
Thank you. I'm going to call John Schultz and Shecky Sundstrom. I hope I said that. Sherry, forgive me, Sherry. Come on up. Whichever one of you want to go first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division. It's my pleasure to be here this afternoon to represent the Department of Consumer and Business Services and to testify in support of House Bill 2756 and the -2 amendments. This goes back to a request from the governor when he asked the department towards the end of the 2005 session and the Management Labor Advisory Committee to review the role of chiropractors in the workers' compensation system, as well as other types of providers, as the committee found appropriate. The governor asked that, actually he emphasized that the review should focus on the needs of workers and employers as the customers to the system. And this bill is the result of the work that was done at the request of the governor. MLAC, along with the Workers' Compensation Division and the Department of Consumer and Business Services, conducted a pretty comprehensive study about care providers in the workers' compensation system in Oregon. Now, the study focused on podiatrists, naturopaths, chiropractic physicians, and physician assistants, but it also included data and findings on medical doctors, doctors of osteopathic, physical therapists, etc., other types of providers. And to cut to the chase, the study found that overall both injured workers and employers are satisfied with the care that's provided currently in the workers' compensation system, although there were some areas that were identified that could be improved. One area that we've already started working on, it doesn't take anything more than administrative type work, is notice to workers about their treatment choices that exist within the system today. It was something that was identified through the work that workers didn't understand some of the choices they already had. In talking about levels of satisfaction, we did do a statistically significant sample of over 2,500 workers. And as example of some of the reports we got back, we found that 84% of workers were satisfied with the quality of care that they received from their workers' compensation care provider, and 87% of workers reported that they were able to see someone who was qualified to treat their condition. In addition to the study, MLAC then held numerous public meetings, subcommittee meetings, and full committee meetings to gather input from stakeholders on the results of the study and what what they should do with this policy question. The four care provider groups themselves provided quite a bit of input, and essentially they proposed changes that would expand their treatment authority within the workers' compensation system. It's important to understand that the treatment's authorities have primarily been in place since the Mahonia Hall reforms of the early 1990s. At that time and to this day, primarily, there's a few treatment providers that have full attending authority status in the workers' compensation system. The limited types of care providers who can act as attending physicians are medical doctors, doctors of osteopathic, maxillofacial surgeons for people who have extremely tough facial injuries, and nurse practitioners can act for a limited period of time, as can chiropractors in the current system for a limited period of time. Now, these attending physician or gatekeeper physicians, as I sometimes refer to them, they manage the workers' access to many of the benefits, time loss benefits, which is wage replacement benefits. They manage their return to work. They help determine what the worker's permanent impairment is. As part of the 1990 reforms, chiropractors were allowed a limited attending physician status. It was for 30 days and 12 visits at that time, and it's continued to be that amount since then. And the 30 days or 12 visits could occur at any point in the claim. Other types of providers, other than MDs, DOs, and maxillofacial surgeons and chiropractors, were allowed to provide compensable services for 30 days or 12 visits from the date of injury, but they were not granted authority to approve time loss benefits, in other words, to provide a substitute wage. They were not allowed to determine impairment for permanent partial disability awards, nor could they manage return to work. And so that was the major difference with those types of providers. Based on the study, based on the public input, based on MLAC looking at the status quo, they have come forward with this bill and with the Dash 2 amendments. And essentially what this bill does, it will allow chiropractic physicians, podiatrists, naturopaths, and physician assistants to act as attending physicians for 60 days or 18 visits, whichever comes first. The clock for the 60 days or the 18 visits starts from the date of the first visit to one of the four of those provider types. It allows the four provider groups to authorize time loss for up to 30 days and to manage the workers' return to work during that 30-day period. It continues to limit the authority to medical doctors, doctors of osteopathic and maxillofacial surgeons to determine if a worker has permanent impairment. This bill also requires the department to develop educational materials about the workers' compensation system. It requires that the four provider types certify that they've read those educational materials to act as attending physician and to provide compensable medical services. And that's the same as exists now for authorized nurse practitioners who become certified within the workers' compensation system. Finally, I just note that in addition to these statutory changes in the Dash 2 amendments, MLAC has agreed that no changes are needed to the status of the provider groups in regard to the managed care organization setting. They did look at this, spent quite a bit of time looking at that, did not have any recommendations for change there. MLAC also asked that the department continues to closely monitor treatment patterns, cost impact, and other factors that are related to this bill's implementation if it is agreed to and passed by the legislature, and to regularly report our findings back to MLAC and to the legislature. And I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Go ahead, Sherry. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Sherry Sundstrom, Management Co-Chair of the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2756 and the Dash 2 amendments. As John Schultz indicated, at the request of the governor, MLAC has spent the last year and a half reviewing the role of care providers in the workers' compensation system. MLAC worked with the department on their care provider study and took testimony from the stakeholders in the in the system. Primarily, we primarily did get testimony from care providers as opposed to workers and employers, and the department did try to get testimony from other stakeholders, but it really ended up being primarily from the care providers. The Dash 2 amendments represent a compromise between management and labor to address four provider groups' concerns about their ability to effectively manage patients' care within the workers' compensation system. The amendments expand the role of chiropractors, physician's assistants, naturopaths, and podiatrists in the workers' compensation system. MLAC believes that this bill with the Dash 2 amendments are a modest step to address the concerns raised by those care providers, but it will maintain the gatekeeper role of the attending physician as agreed in the 1990 reforms. It is also consistent with the view of both management and labor members of MLAC that changes should be incremental in order to maintain the long-term stability of Oregon's workers' compensation system. To ensure that the changes have the outcome intended, MLAC has asked the department to closely monitor patterns, cost impact, and other factors as the bill is implemented and to regularly report their findings, which is consistent with how we usually run over our affairs. We like to hear back from the department on what we've done and what the impact it has made. So any questions?
Well, Mr. Schultz, just, you know, this first public hearing, I just want to ask you to go around the committee and make sure they're all comfortable with these changes before we bring it back. So, and I know you would have anyway, but
yes. Any questions?
Representative Rosenbaum.
So what's the rationale for having a different length of time for treating with medical care and authorizing time less? And how is that supposed to work then if you're still disabled from working during that time and you're seeing one of these providers?
I'll try to answer those questions in the reverse order. One of the questions you asked was how does it work practically for the worker who may still be disabled from work? They're seeing one of these limited providers, maybe the time that they've used their 60 days or their 18 visits. At that point, the worker would need to see a provider who qualifies as an attending physician without those limitations. So that would basically be they would need to see an MD, a DO, or a maxillofacial surgeon. Most of the time, it's going to be an MD or a DO in that situation. The MD or DO...
Mr. Schultz, just in case anybody's watching, and for the chair's benefit, use not acronyms. Tell me what DO and MD and all that stuff.
I apologize.
That's another one. Let's explain what that is, too.
I apologize, Mr. Chair.
That's quite all right.
I shouldn't do that, and I did. And I appreciate you catching me at it. Management Labor Advisory Committee is when I say MLAC, I'm sorry, that's what I mean. Management Labor Advisory Committee. And a medical doctor a doctor of osteopathic are the two types of physicians that are attending physicians now, in addition to the maxillofacial surgeon, who can see workers and treat them and prescribe time loss and impairment without any limitations. The new types of providers that this bill would allow to come into the system with limits, once the worker runs into that limit, they would have to then go back to see a medical doctor or a doctor of osteopathic. And at that point, that type of doctor would probably have two choices, either treat the worker themselves and provide whatever they would normally provide, or refer the worker back to the other provider who was seeing them in the first place, a naturopath or a chiropractic physician, for example, and through that way the worker would be authorized actually through the attending physician for whatever services that they needed or for the time loss, but it would require that referral back and rechecking in with the medical doctor or doctor of osteopathic. And I think that answers your last question.
So, clarification, then. Reading your testimony, it sounded to me like these other categories could provide medical treatment for 60 days or 18 visits under these dash 2 amendments without referral from somebody else, and that's true.
That is, Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, that is correct.
And
yes.
So...
Representative, please go ahead, carry on.
And so, but if the person were disabled from working after the first 30 days, even though they can continue for another 30 days, say they were seeing a physician's assistant or a chiropractor or one of the others, at that 30-day point, they have to go see another doctor that they may not have seen at all to date to get authorized to continue to stay off from work. That seems like it would be adding to the cost of the system.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, at the 60-day time limit, that is what would happen if the worker needed to be able to continue to receive time loss under this bill. Currently, it's 30 days.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. But I guess I'm reading this to say that after 30 days, if you want to continue time loss, then somebody else, namely an MD or one of those other, a medical doctor or one of those other...
A DO.
...categories, you have to go see somebody else to authorize your time loss after 30 days, even though you could continue for 60 days getting medical treatment from a physician's assistant or a chiropractor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, that's not my understanding of the intent of the bill, but perhaps I'm missing something. Could you...
I'm looking at your testimony, and I'm looking at the staff measure summary, and I haven't found this in the amendments, but the staff measure summary says, a chiropractor serving as an attending physician may authorize the payment of temporary disability for a period not to exceed 30 days from the first visit. Yet you can continue now to see a chiropractor under these dash 2 amendments for 60 days. But if you're still disabled from working, so you need somebody to authorize your time loss for the second 30 days, then it sounds like the chiropractor can't do it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I would like to draw your attention to page 4 of the dash 2 amendments. And at this, on line 17, and if this is not clear enough, we will need to go back in and tackle this. But it is my understanding that starting on line 17 is where we lay, where it would be laid out in the statute that the four different types of providers, starting with the chiropractic physicians and running through onto page 5 through line 6, that they have a cumulative total of 60 days and 18 visits. And this is under the definition of who can act as an attending physician. under 12 in the definition. So my understanding is that what you can act for an attending physician for this time, if you're, let's just say, a doctor of chiropractic for 60 days, and that includes the ability to prescribe time loss. It includes the ability to manage the worker's return to work, either release to return to work or take somebody off work.
But Mr. Chair,
Representative.
So, but look at page, the bottom of page 18, continuing on page 19. So that would be parentheses 2, small b, big b, where it says a medical service provider who is not an attending physician cannot authorize the payment of temporary disability compensation. Then the new language says a medical service provider qualified to serve as an attending physician under, and it cites another section, may authorize the payment of temporary disability compensation for a period not to exceed 30 days from the date of the first visit of the initial claim. So that's what I'm looking at. And it sounds to me like even though they can provide medical treatment for 60 days, they can only authorize time less for 30 days. And I see somebody else at the witness table.
Yeah, and normally I would snap at people for just walking up here, but Ms. Trussell, I'm confident you have something to offer, and I'm grateful for your presence. So please carry on.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and I also happen to sit on the Management Labor Advisory Committee on Workers' Compensation. And your comments about the 30 days of authorizing time loss and the 60 days of treatment accurately reflect. The time loss would be authorized for only up to 30 days, and then they would have to see either a medical doctor or a doctor of osteopathy. And that was also part of the discussion that IMLAC had when we were compromising on the bill. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, I just would still pose my original question, though, that it seems like then you're forcing somebody to go see another treating physician that they may not have seen at all, and that wouldn't that cost, and then they can still continue to see the same person they've been seeing with no pre-authorization. It seems like that would be adding to the cost of the system.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, that's one of the reasons that we're going to be monitoring what happens with the implementation of this bill going forward. But there were claims where they were already going beyond the 12 visits, and it's not that we are not anticipating a huge number that will be impacted. Most of them are back to work before the 30 days, but that's something that would be part of the monitoring going forward.
I think the answer to your question is yes. But any other questions of this nice panel today? And thank you, Ms. Trussell.
And let me apologize, Mr. Chair, and to the panel for getting my facts wrong.
That's quite right, but I charge you, I beg you, make sure all these folks, before we move on this, especially the chair, are squared away on everything. Anything else before I call the rest of the folks?
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Phil Donovan and Scott Beyer, please. Oh, excuse me, and Dr. Jason Black, come on up with Phil, please. I think that's right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians, and with me is Dr. Black, who's a member of our association, also seated in the front row, professors and students at the College of Naturopathic Medicine. You probably guessed that they were the public because they weren't sitting at the back of the room with the rest of the lobby. So, anyway.
They're listening attentively, unlike the people in the back of the
room. That's right. They're trying to hide their PKs from you. Mr. Chair, we're here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians in support of the legislation that is before you. The Management Labor Advisory Committee did conduct a study and did identify that workers are seeking out the care of naturopathic physicians. And frankly, with the growing acceptance of naturopathic medicine, with the growing size of the profession itself, it only makes sense that you're going to see more and more injured workers seeking out the care of naturopathic doctors. So we were very active participants in the process because we wanted to make sure that folks understood that naturopathic physicians are primary care physicians. In other words, people go and see a naturopathic doctor for their everyday health care needs, and that they grow trust and a rapport with those doctors, and that they're going to want to continue to see them, whether they're going in to get seen for a cold or whether they're going in to be seen for an injury related to the job. And so anyways, we've distributed testimony in support of the legislation. We referenced the Dash 1 amendments, hadn't realized that there was a fine-tuning of the Dash 2 amendments. But having said that, I did want to have Dr. Black here because he has treated patients of his who've been injured on the job and can actually relate some very first-hand experience and knowledge to this good committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Doctor, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dr. Jason Black, naturopathic physician. I have an integrated clinic in McMinnville. And I feel that the reason that I'm here and the reason that I do support HB 2756 with Dash 2 amendments is because I currently feel that the position on it is it's kind of broke as far as the situation with patients being able to seek out the type of care that they want. 60% of my patients are, I am their primary care. I kind of oversee, I'm the gatekeeper for their health. And I have had situations where patients have had on-the-job injuries, you know, that have wanted to see me. And their preference for seeing a naturopath is primarily because they've maybe experienced conventional medicine, which hasn't worked for them. So they want to try more less invasive procedures and more natural medicines that can support them without some of the side effects that maybe they have experienced. I have the clinical training. I have the educational background to be a physician and actually oversee their care. I can refer when needed. I can refer to have diagnostic imaging if needed. I can read x-rays if needed. And these patients trust me. I have, you know, I have had a couple of situations where patients have, you know, had a workers' comp injury. One in particular, I was her attending physician for over 3 years, and you have a letter there from her stating her experience. But she sustained an injury. We had basically did an assessment and kind of went through the proper protocols of assessing her injury, went on to treat her, and I ended up referring her to a physiatrist who I work closely with in town to oversee some of the care that we were doing to see if there's anything she could do with some of the pain. But she ran into kind of some difficulty with the insurance company and me being able to oversee her care. This was in the first 30 days of injury. You know, I had an insurance adjuster tell her that she could not be seen by a naturopath within the 30 days at all, period, and that any of the medical services that she would endure at our clinic, she was going to be fully responsible for, even though, you know, she could see us. And so I ended up having to, you know, call Labor of Industry and, you know, kind of make a claim as far as getting coverage for this person, and, you know, it was kind of undue stress. After the 30 days, she still needed care, so I had to refer her to another physician, and that physician had to refer her back to me. And the physician had no clue as far as some of the natural medicines I was using to help her. You know, she is a patient that does not want, you know, pain medications. She doesn't want sleep aids. She, you know, she wants to be treated with natural medicines which work and that have scientific background, which I am trained to use. So, you know, that is one instance as far as where the system that is set up. There's some questionable. There's not a set in stone, clearly marked out. You know, where even some of the insurance companies can really follow when you're actually dealing with adjusters. It's still sort of a gray area. I've had, you know, another patient, my first patient that I actually saw a workers' comp case. I had seen her past the 30 days and it wasn't clear as far as what the law was. She had a lawyer that was representing her from her injury. And she wanted to know. I was her attending physician. She had seen another doctor, though, in the interim. And when she had this injury, contacted her lawyer to see if she could actually see me. He went in, you know, read the as far as the law and said, well, I see nothing that clearly states you cannot see him. We went on to treat her for over you know, a month and a half. And her bills were not getting paid, and basically she accrued quite a bit of debt of our clinic, and I had referred her to a chiropractor and massage therapist. She was doing very well. Pain was managed. She wasn't on any narcotics, doing extremely well, and she ended up, you know, leaving care because she accrued a large amount of medical bills. Subsequently, unfortunately, I, you know, had not seen her since our 6 months later, and, you know, she was on prednisone and OxyContin and trazodone for sleep and being managed at a pain clinic with, you know, an 8 out of 10 pain. You know, those are some of the situations that, you know, that I have experienced. You know, I think I would like to reiterate that it's the preference of the citizens of Oregon to actually have the type of health care that they choose. Naturopathic physicians are, you know, educated to be primary care, and we should be able to attain that. You know, we, you know, 60% of my patients, I know many of my colleagues' patients, we're it. They do not have a doctor of osteopathy. They do not have a medical doctor that's overseeing their care. You know, they choose to have a naturopath for certain reasons, and I think they should have that ability if they have an on-the-job injury to have that care followed through as is any other, you know, medical doctor, osteopathic physician who's overseeing their patient's care. Thank you very much.
No, thank you, doctor. And just for the record, I was smiling about the baby crying in the back room, not the plight of
the
patient.
Okay.
No, you didn't pick that up on the TV there. Anyway, thank you for that thorough explanation. Any questions here? And I have a personal experience with a naturopath. I had the worst cold one time, and her ex-husband is a friend of mine, and we were hanging the sign up out on her practice, and she gave me the most vile black stuff I've ever ingested, and I tell you, in a couple days, it was gone. She told me not to go skiing in the middle of the week, but I did. But I don't know what it was. But it cleared up what I had, and that's all I care.
If you can take a nature pest medicine, you can take any medicine.
Right. So. All right. Well, thank you. It worked, though. That's what matters. Any questions, these gentlemen? All right. Thank you very
much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your time.
I'd like to call Michael Mason and Tom Barrows, please. And is Scott Beyer in the room? Oh, come on up, Scott. I called you earlier. I don't know if you heard me or not. And Tom and Michael, you want to come on up too?
Be right back. Vice Chair Escobar, my name is Scott Beyer. I'm a physician assistant. I've been practicing and committee members as a physician assistant for 17 years. And I'm here in support of House Bill 2756. I'm giving a little bit of information on how PAs or physician assistants work in this state. We're a little bit different than the other groups that are in this bill in the fact that we are combined with a physician. So a physician assistant is a dependent practitioner. So we work with the physician in an office and a team approach. The reason that we needed to increase our ability to treat injured workers were for a couple of different reasons. Number one was that a lot of times our physicians are either not in the office or on vacation when we are seeing patients. And the way that the statutes were originally set, we were stuck both with time loss and the ability to treat that injured worker. We could do 30 days or 12 visits from the first injury. For instance, myself, I work in orthopedics. So a lot of times, 30 days had already expired from the time of injury before they actually were referred to orthopedics. So when they came into our office, they had already been treated by their primary care or someone else and then had a referral sent over to us. So what we're trying to do is work in our situation as a dependent practitioner, working with the physician to help work with these injured workers to get them into the system and then get them continued follow-up care. So, in Representative Rosenbaum's question, for us, 30 days would work because that's all we need until our physicians are involved with that patient. For other people, they're dependent practitioners and they would and may need further time period. But in our situation, where we're running across issues is the fact that if I have an injured worker come into the office and my physician's not in the office, I'm unable to do time loss. In rural areas, we can as a PA, but those are fewer and fewer areas that are available. So for that person, what I end up having to do is do a time loss form and tell them that I'm going to have to get my physician to sign it when they get back in, which usually creates a havoc both for the employer and also for the insurance company. So what this would do is it would allow us to continue treating that patient until that physician comes in. A physician has to be in the office at least one half a day every 2 weeks seeing patients. So there's a ability that's with our practice of the Board of Medical Examiners that there is a way that they evaluate our charts and co-sign our charts, a certain percentage depending on how long you've been practicing and how long you've been doing this. So we are in support of House Bill 2756. We've been working with Management and Labor Advisory Committee for the last year and a half, and working with them, they felt that this was probably the best avenue to take care of that problem in our setting to help us work with the injured workers. Thank you.
Thank you. Who's next?
Okay. First, thank you, Chair Schaffler and members of the Business and Labor Committee. My name is Michael Mason. I'm living in Portland, representing the Oregon Doctors of Chiropractic. And they have asked me to appear to enthusiastically support the -2 amendments to House Bill 2756. We, again, have worked for over a year and a half with the Management Labor Advisory Committee and the Department of Consumer and Business Services to come up with an improvement to the access for injured workers, particularly for for chiropractors in our association's case. It's an important bill. It increases, as you know, the days and number of visits of treatment for chiropractors seeing injured workers. ODOT believes this change represents significant progress, major progress, actually, in an ongoing effort to increase injured workers' access to health services that they need and deserve. And my partner, not my domestic partner, but my partner, Bob Olson, apologizes for not being able to be here. He had to work on another bill. So thank you again, and we urge your adoption of the Dash 2 amendments and do pass recommendation of 2756-2.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Tom Barrows, representing the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association, which is podiatrists. We also support this with the Dash 2. We have a bill in that would have granted full attending physician status, or would if passed. I understand that's probably not likely going to pass with the passage of this session. We're hopeful, though, that after a couple of years and ability to show some data, that might in the future be possible. So we're supporting this for now, but looking to the future as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for these gentlemen?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
So I see it sounds like a deal has been struck here, but I'm still curious if no one finds it odd that or disruptive or costly that people, I mean, I understand the situation of a physician's assistant who's working with an MD, but for other categories of providers, it still seems to me that it is strange that there would be a 60-day period for medical treatment but only a 30-day period for time loss. And that I would think at that 30-day period when somebody has to leave your care and go see another treating physician, if they're still disabled from working, they might not see much point in going two places. They have to go to the other place anyway. Or if I'm wrong about that, then in fact they're going to see two different providers and costing more money to the system by doing that.
If I may, Chair Schaffler and Representative Rosenbaum, you pose an apt question. I think that the answer for the Oregon Doctors of Chiropractic is that this is a reform that will enable chiropractic doctors to demonstrate savings to the system. And we're not, the members of our association are not concerned about losing patients. There's a lot of loyalty by those injured workers to their chiropractic doctor, so we don't have that concern. Of course, we are hopeful that this will lead to further reform. So, but we think that this will give us, you know, that period of a year and a half at least to demonstrate the reduced costs, especially that will result from greater freedom of access.
Okay. Any further questions of this panel? All right, gentlemen, thank you very much. Well, folks, you got everybody's phone number, I think, on here. Continue to ask those questions, and we'll have it back. I'm curious about my friend from Southeast Portland's questions as well. So, all right. Would anyone else like to testify to House Bill 2756 today? All right, seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2756. Is there anything for the good of the order today? Seeing nothing, we're adjourned.